Welcome to Leadership Conversations with Nikki Gumbel. In the build-up to Leadership Conference 2024, we'll be sharing conversations with leaders from around the world. Leadership Conference is happening at the Royal Albert Hall from the 6th to 7th May. You can book your place now at leadershipconference.org.uk. Today, Nikki is joined by Arthur Brooks. Arthur is a number one New York Times bestseller, colleague of Oprah Winfrey, columnist for The Atlantic, and a professor of happiness at Harvard University.
Arthur, thank you so much for joining us. We were hugely disappointed that you couldn't make the leadership conference this year, and we're very much hoping you'll come next year, and if not next year, as soon as we can get you.
I would love that, Nikki. Thank you so much for inviting me and the opportunity to talk to you here today. Even though it's virtually, I think we might be able to reach even more people.
Yes, that's true. Well, let me introduce to our listeners. I'm excited to be here with Professor Arthur Brooks, an ex-professional French horn player and a CEO, and then at age of 55, accepted a professorship at Harvard University and created a class on the science of happiness. He's a regular columnist of The Atlantic with hundreds of thousands of readers and author of, well, many books, but two that I have been reading. This one, From Strength to Strength, number one New York Times bestseller, endorsed by the Daily Mail and the Dalai Lama. That's an interesting combination. And then also this, The Art and Science of Getting Happier, Build the Life You Wanted, Arthur Brooks and Oprah Winfrey. Again, an unusual combination, but a very, very interesting one. And there's so much I want to ask you about from what I've been reading about you. But let me start with, it's fascinating to me that you've written on this, you're an expert, you're probably like the world's leading expert on the subject of happiness. And yet you say that's not your background. When you look at your parents, your grandfather was gloomy, your father was anxious, and you describe yourself as naturally gloomy and anxious. So what got you into happiness?
I wanted more of it is the answer. And you know, I'm a social scientist by background. And one of the interesting things about being a social scientist dedicated to behavior is that you can learn about yourself and try to make your own life better. And in so doing, you can pass on these ideas to other people. Now, it's important to use our knowledge to lift other people up and bring them together. That's my view. That's my view as a Christian, by the way. I mean, everything that we're trying to do is apostolate. Our work on earth is a kind of a priestly vocation, whether we're dedicated to propagating the Christian faith in a conventional way or not. And I thought to myself, well, you know, I believe that we can be happier. And in so doing, we can glorify God more. But that's really going to have to start with me. I'm not a very good apostle for happiness if I'm unhappy all the time, if I'm grumpy and grouchy and anxious all the time. And so I dedicated myself to learning the best science about happiness, to applying it to my own life, to improving my life, and then teaching these ideas to other people. So this is just, Nikki, this is just my Christian apostolate starting at home.
Yeah. And you have these, the four pillars. And just talk about them from your personal point of view. So you talk about family, friendship, work, faith. But so how do those apply to you personally? How do you, in your own life, how do you prioritize family, friendship, work, and faith?
Well, a lot. And actually, isolating those four pillars was a more or less a scientific endeavor. I mean, I've been looking at the scientific literature on the habits of the happiest people for a really long time. And you can find 10,000 habits of the happiest people, but four really stick out. And it's important to have a smaller number as opposed to a larger number so people can learn and understand what you're saying and apply these things to their own lives. And the big four are faith, family, friendship, and work that serves other people. These are the characteristics of the people who have the happiest lives. And I saw this again and again and again in the science. You see neuroscientific explanations for why this is the case, but just the people who work on these things over the course of their lives, they tend to get happier as they get older. Life is just a more of a flourishing experience for them. And so I thought to myself, how am I turning that strategy into the happiness pension plan for my own life? And I went through and I created kind of a protocol for all four of these things. And over the past 20 years or so, these have really, I mean, my life has coalesced around these pillars and in really nice ways, I have to say. Now, it really starts with my faith. The faith is the basis for everything for me. When I teach this to my students, by the way, I'm not getting up in front of my students at Harvard University and say, go to church, you heathens. That's not my approach. It turns out that probably wouldn't be the best approach, among other things, for keeping employment at Harvard University. What I talk to them about is the fact that the happiest people have a sense of the transcendent in their lives, whether it's traditionally religious or not, because left to our devices, Mother Nature will force us to become the star of our own psychodrama. All about me, my money and my lunch and my commute and my job. And it's just so boring, Nikki. And what you need to be a happier person is to zoom out and become small. Now, of course, this is central to many ideas in the Christian gospel, but it's also empirically true from a psychological perspective. And so I talk about different ways to do that. And one of those ways, my way, your way, the way for a lot of people who are involved in your movement, is the faith of our youth, which is the Christian faith. And so I tell my students about what my journey actually is, and I have built my life around that, quite frankly, especially over the past 5 years or so. I go to Mass every day. The nice thing about being a Catholic is that we have a franchise system. It's sort of like McDonald's, which means we have the same product in every, it's more like Starbucks, I'd have to say. And that means that I can go to Mass any day, any place in the world where I happen to be. And that's how I start my day, with some exercise.
And your wife was an atheist and is now a Catholic.
My wife is Spanish, which makes things complicated from a Christian perspective. As you know, it's a deeply Catholic country where almost no one practices. She's from Barcelona, where 3% of the population actually goes to Mass. She was baptized and never went to church after that until she met me. So hard red atheist background, to be sure, but with a Catholic overhang. It's the weirdest thing. It's hard for us to understand. So
but the faith is there now in your marriage and with your children.
Yeah. So I was raised in a Christian home. I became a Catholic as a teenager. I was raised in a Protestant home, but I became a Catholic as a teenager. And it's always been central to my life. And when I married my wife, my great proposition was that I was going to get her into church. And she said, knock yourself out, buddy. She said, good luck with that. But, I'm having the last laugh, I have to say. The truth is that today she's my guru. She leads me on paths of righteousness. Yeah. My wife is literally pursuing graduate education as we speak in sacred scripture and theology. She gives her, the way that she makes her living is by talking to, is going to parishes and talking to women, especially immigrant women in native Spanish, about the gospel. She knows more about the Catholic faith than I ever will. Ha ha. Joke's on her.
So how in practice do you prioritize your family with all the other things that are going on in your life?
That's an easy thing to neglect for hard-charging strivers, which is a lot of the people that are watching us right now. They're successful people. They're serious about their work. And the result is that it's very easy for the most mystical love relationships that we didn't choose to get deprioritized. That's incredibly important that we not do that. These are gifts that we are given, and they truly are mystical. Now, I can explain the neurochemistry of why we have a particular bond with our kin, but it doesn't really matter. The neurochemistry, I believe, comes from heaven as well. And it's important, it's crucial, it's fundamental that we prioritize these relationships. And so I do that in point of fact. I did not have a very close relationship with my family in the way that I would like to have a relationship with my own adult children. And now I'm a grandfather with their children as well. So we live as close together as we can. practically speaking, we're making plans to be closer together. I try to see I talk to all three of my adult children every day. I see my grandson constantly. We're thinking about ways where we can move to be not, we're not going to live in a cult compound, but something closer together than we would have otherwise. And the reason is because I don't want just a cordial relationship with my family. I want the life-giving sustenance that a true family bond can bring. And I believe is a gift from the Lord.
And then friends, I mean, our daughter always says to us, you're not going to have any friends because it's so hard, isn't it, with family. And we got now 10 grandchildren and with all the pace of work and stuff, it's so easy to neglect your friends. How do you keep up with your friends with all the busyness of your life?
Well, you have to remember that there's more than one kind of friend. And busy people, busy professional, successful people, they have a lot of friends. The problem is that they're deal friends, not real friends. And we know the difference between them. R&D, real and deal. And the greatest source of loneliness that people have in their lives is it's too much deal, not enough real. Too much virtual, not enough in real life as well. And so it's a question of maintaining proper hygiene and having discipline about that, quite frankly. It takes work. If you're spending time only on your profession, on your professional vocation all the time, you will be surrounded by people, but these are not the people that will take your 3 a.m. phone call. These are certainly not people who know, Nikki, that you have 10 grandchildren. They know that they know what you do for a living. And that's really just not good enough. And so the result is you have to actually set aside the time and do the work to maintain these relationships. That's not easy for me. This is the hard one for me. I'm not going to lie. I mean, maintaining my personal friendships, my family and faith are easier for me than my friendships. Yes. So I'm a real extrovert, which means that I'm surrounding myself with people that I know a little bit all the time. Not good enough for happiness, not good enough for communion with others. And so I need to double and triple down on the two or three relationships of people that I'm really close to and who know me and who, and by the way, here's the key thing to keep in mind for people who are wondering, how do I know if it's real or deal? Deal friends are incredibly useful to you. So therefore, real friends are useless. Beautifully, cosmically useless. If you don't have enough useless people that you love in your life, and I don't mean worthless, I have those friends too. If you don't have enough useless friends, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah. And work, because I mean, your job, obviously, we're both very blessed to have jobs which we love and bring huge satisfaction. But what happens if you've got a job like, this is the only job I can get and I don't particularly enjoy my job. I just do it because I need to earn a living and I've got to, you know, provide for my wife and my children or whatever. How do you make work purposeful how did that fourth pillar work if you're not if you don't have the luxury of a choice of a job that has an obvious purpose?
Yeah. So I have, by training, I'm an economist, and so I've looked a lot at labor markets. And one of the things that I always wondered was, what are the jobs that are most fun, and how can they be a source of joy? It turns out that's the wrong question. I mean, I know people who have incredibly fun-sounding jobs. They play baseball for a living, and they're unhappy. I know. Yes. I mean, I could be a professor of happiness and be a miserable person if I actually focused on the wrong things, which a lot of people do. The more famous you are, by the way, generally speaking, the unhappier you will be. That is a life reward that people think will bring great happiness, but you can only ever be happy in spite of the admiration that you have of strangers and the prestige that you actually have. Happiness from work only comes from two things. I don't care if you're a roofer or a bus driver or a politician or a priest. What brings joy from work is earning your success, the belief that you're creating value with your life and you're recognized for it and that you're serving others. And you know who those people are and you can actually see the result of your work. Now, that's hard for certain people to be sure, but you can do that a lot more. I give people advice all the time. You know, the other week I was on television here in the United States on a national television show and I was taking questions from the studio audience, and one of them said, I hate my job. I feel like a cog in the machine. I feel it's meaningless. How can I create joy from my work? And here was my answer to that. I said, probably you're sitting in a cubicle. He said, yeah. And there's a cubicle farm around you. He said, yeah, that's pretty much right. I said, well, okay, 2 o'clock in the afternoon tomorrow when you get to work, Go into the break room and take a fresh cup of coffee and bring it to the person in the cubicle next to you and say, you know what? You look like you could use a fresh cup of coffee. And look at the, notice the look on that other person's face and you will become the nice guy in your office. And that's what's going to transform your work. That's how service works. Service is little. Service is serving the people around you. The poor, by the way, the corporal act of mercy to serve the poor.
Yeah.
The poor person is the guy who needs a cup of coffee in the next cubicle, quite frankly.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting what you say about fame, that, you know, the more famous you are, the less likely you are to be happy, kind of thing. But I think the same is true of leadership. At this conference, leadership conference this year at the Albert Hall, I want to talk about why no one should want to be a leader, for the same reason that no one should want to be famous, because leadership is, fame is the price you pay for doing something.
Right.
You're famous, but you didn't go after fame. You went after teaching people about happiness and it made you famous. But that's a price you pay for what you've done. And leadership, to me, is the same. It's the price. No one should want to be a leader because leadership's just hassle. But if you want to do something, you're probably going to have to lead. So talk a bit about leadership and how that it interrelates with what you do about happiness and how you avoid leadership just becoming a hassle rather than
that. You know, the truth is that certain people should actually actively avoid leadership, as a matter of fact. And, you know, I do a lot of work on the neuroscience and behavioral science of different professions, for example. And one of the things you find about leadership is when people become, they get into the boss role over other people, that two things tend to occur. Their happiness decreases. And on average, your happiness will not actually come back to where it was from before you were the boss after until about 2 years in. The second thing is that your anger systematically rises. And there's a reason for that. The reason is because you actually have less control. And when you have less control, your anger will rise. It's a normal human reaction. You bridle against, you rebel against the things that are constraining you. And the more leadership you have, the more constraints actually are on you for all sorts of reasons that I think that everybody watching us can imagine. So the result is that certain people who have anger management issues or who tend toward loneliness because it's quite isolating to be a leader, or who already are struggling with happiness, leadership is not the secret to making you happier. It's just that that's actually will lower your quality of life.
Yeah.
You have to think good and hard before you grab that brass ring. That brass ring is problematic for a lot of people's lives. But if you do, then you have to recognize that it brings many blessings, but those blessings have everything to do with your service, not with your prestige, not with your status. Think service, not status, is actually how you should think about leadership and happiness.
Which is Jesus's model. Actually, the more and that's what I want to talk about at this conference, the leadership conference, is because I think our society has got so many issues with leadership. I mean, leadership in politics, in the church, there's so many issues facing us all. It's such a challenge. And what do we learn from Jesus? Jesus's model of leadership is actually so different from how the world, but yet the world seems to be sort of looking now more at Jesus. You get, you know, what you're saying about service is now something that's being adopted much more by the world. You would have secular books. The motto of Sandhurst is serve to lead. So it's kind of like Jesus's model is being recognized as the model of leadership, the only model of leadership really that works.
Yeah, I know. And the problem with that, of course, is that it's not that these concepts, these secular concepts, are untrue. It's empirically robust. We find this in the data and in the experiments again and again and again that look, everything that the Lord taught stands up to modern social science. The problem is these things are hard. And it's very difficult to get outside of your own ego to serve others as opposed to serving yourself, unless you dedicate yourself to something greater than you. That the secret to actually doing, look, it's pretty easy to understand it. And it's pretty easy to assent to the idea that servant leadership is really important. The problem is executing on that. The problem is subjugating your own will to do something that's quite contrary to Mother Nature's dictates. Mother Nature is a tyrant, and she wants you to sing the me, me, me song over and over again, to exalt yourself constantly. Why? Because that gives you a greater chance during the Pleistocene of getting adequate calories and lots of mates. Well, guess what? The divine path doesn't follow those dictates. And so therefore, the only way for you to execute on these truths, at least the best way I've ever found to execute on these truths, is to dedicate myself to the Savior. To subjugate my will not to the truth of social science data, but to the truth of the Christian gospel. It's the only way that I know how to actually do these things that I'm finding in my own research.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love your book, From Strength to Strength. The fact that you talk about fluid intelligence versus crystallized intelligence. How as you move on in life, your role changes, and some of the things, because you move from being a musician to the creative. I'm tennis players are not going to reach their peak at 60. But other aspects of our life do actually mature and become grow as we get older. Just talk a little bit about what you've seen what this says on the cover is finding success, happiness, and deep purpose in the second half of life, which I think it's such an interesting thing, because in the UK, when the pension age came in. When the pension came in, rather, you got it at 70, and life expectancy was 52. Hmm. Now, the pension is at 66, and if you reach 66, life expectancy is 85. So you've got this whole, the Guardian has a column, a new life at 60, and people are looking at the second half. So in the secular world, people are looking at what do you do in the second half of your life? Right. And this book, From Strength to Strength, which I love, is all about that. How you can, in the second half of your life is like, oh, no, I'm going to retire and then I'm just going to play golf whatever, or just put my feet up and get ready to die. It's an opportunity for something to do something new.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I wrote the book because, quite frankly, I was, in my early 50s at the time, and I wanted the answer. So I wrote the book to actually figure out the way for myself. Once again, to be a little selfish, this is me-search, not research. And the truth is, there was nothing out there that I could find for this that was actually using the behavioral science and philosophy and neuroscience in a responsible, synthetic way. To come up with solutions to what the best life was and how we could make the investments beforehand to live better as we got older. The basic truth is this: our strengths change as we move through our lives. Now, that makes sort of intuitive sense, but we don't know exactly what that means. Early on in life, we have a lot of what neuroscientists and social scientists call fluid intelligence. And that's the ability to innovate, to think quickly, to use working memory, to focus a lot, and to solve problems on our own. So very bright people. My students at the Harvard Business School, some of the smartest young people I've ever met. And they can crack any case, remember anything, focus for hours at a time in ways that I can only dream of. Yeah. And it's just amazing. And that fluid intelligence makes you better and better and better at doing things on your own through your 20s and 30s. It tends to peak that intelligence at about age 40. We all notice in our 40s and 50s that our working memory tends to be in decline. That's not an expression of cerebral degradation. It's not there's something wrong with our brains. That really has to do with the filing system. When you have so much information, that compiling memories gets more cumbersome, as a matter of fact. Your brain is kind of like a vast library. The reason that my young adult kids in their 20s have such a good memory is because their library, Nikki, has one book in it, And, I have to go searching around the stacks to find things and put things together. At least this is what I like to tell myself. It makes me feel a little bit
better. Okay, that's interesting. Yeah.
It's important for us.
It's comforting when you can't remember things. It's not, it's not a sign of something going wrong. It's more to do with an inevitable process of having a lot of books in the library.
Yeah, I have too much information in there. And so, what's that guy's name? I have to send my librarian up to the fifth floor. To the back of the stacks to find something in a book, for example. And 5 minutes later, he comes back with the answer. And
yeah.
His name is Mike, but Mike is long gone, and I feel like an old man. Well, that's what's going on. The trouble is that those kinds of skills are central to fluid intelligence, and those things, they decline naturally with age. What happens is that there's a second kind of intelligence that's rising in your 40s and 50s and your 60s and 70s and stays high in your 80s and 90s as long as God gives you your marbles, which is called crystallized intelligence. Crystallized intelligence is not based on lightning fast memory or even innovation. It has everything to do with synthesizing the things that you know and being able to express them. You find, for example, that a vast library is really good for having a healthy vocabulary. I can speak better now than I could certainly in my 40s. I can lecture more coherently. I can write better than I ever did. I'm also better at seeing good metaphors. This reminds me of that because I've seen a lot of different things. I have pattern recognition skills. I'm a better teacher. Young professors will come see me right out of graduate school, then brand new professors, and they say, "What's the secret to getting great teaching evaluations?" And I say, "Get old." Why? Because you need the crystallized intelligence, which is the ability to tell a story and to teach other people. Now, here's the important thing, Nikki. We have to stop clinging to what we were good at. We have to step away from our innovator curve onto our instructor curve. That's the key. And in every profession, every single profession, there's an innovator version and an instructor version. I work a lot with lawyers. And, you know, lawyers, they generally are really good in their 20s and 30s at individual litigation, cracking cases quickly. They should be looking to lead teams of lawyers, to be managing partner when they're in their 60s. That's the natural progression. Or in entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurs should try to have some incredible invention early on, but they should become venture capitalists when they're in their 60s to find new entrepreneurs and teach them and train them to create real value. I was doing mathematical research in my 30s that was so sophisticated, I can't read it today. I don't understand my own math. But today I write for an audience of about 500,000 readers a week of non-specialists. I've become a teacher. I've become a public educator, and that's what I'm naturally supposed to be good at. Now, that research was really good for helping me design my career, but now I give that advice to a lot of other people to find their crystallized intelligence curve.
Yeah, it's so interesting, Arthur, because one of the things that I'm really – in the Church of England one of the things that we're really pushing is the Caleb stream. Because what happened was this. I had a friend who became a Christian the same week as I did at Cambridge. And he'd worked for ICR. He'd been in business. He'd been a management consultant. He'd been a head teacher. And he was a recruiter of head teachers. But he wasn't allowed to read the lesson in his local church because he wasn't qualified lay reader. And I said to him, why don't you get ordained? Why don't you get ordained in the Church of England? It was my wife Pippa who suggested it. And we got them to agree. He'd been a lay chaplain for 14 years. And we got the Church of England to agree, the bishop, I went to see the bishop, said that he would be ordained in 9 months because he'd been a lay chaplain for 14 years. He would be ordained in 9 months, and a year later he was ordained priest. So this guy is totally brilliant. So we started a Caleb stream. So Caleb, you know, was still going strong at 85. So, and if you think all the people who've been in business or in, a lecturer in a university or whatever, and they, what they really love is ministry. They've worked hard, or they've been a bus driver, they've worked hard, they've loved, but they've done it. It hasn't been their primary love. Their primary love has been ministry. Now at 60, they can do a year's training. They've got all the maturity. They've got all of that. And then, he heads up the Caleb stream, and we're finding so many. Just take the Church of England. There are only about 500,000 people who go to church in the Church of England. Most of them are aged between 58 and 72. Right. And so there's this just massive opportunity. And there's 6,000 churches with no vicar. So if you could just get 6,000 out of the 500,000 aged between 58 and 72 to get ordained, you could fill every one. So this is why I was particularly interested in this, because this is evidence. These people have crystallized intelligence. Right. Who better to run a church than someone right. who's got crystallized intelligence, a whole lifetime in the business world as a doctor, but all their life they've been in church, they've been growing in right. maturity in their spiritual life, to then go and teach, to give communion, to do all those things. So to me, this is such an important thing for not just for everybody out there, but also for the church to see that there's a massive potential in this group, which didn't exist 50 years ago, because 50 years ago, you retired and you died. Now you retired and you've got 25 years.
I agree completely. And, you know, the whole idea of missionary work, understanding that to be a Christian is to live in the mission field, no matter what you're doing. But to think about your life in a pastoral way, and as you get older, being better at doing that because of the rise in your crystallized intelligence. So whether you're ordained a priest or not, you're in a priestly profession and you're getting better at it as time goes by. Take it seriously. By the way, your friend, what an inspirational story. One more year, Nikki, and he could become a Catholic priest. You know that you've got this special deal. If you call before midnight tonight, you don't even have to be celibate to be.
No, there are loads of Catholic priests who are not, and lots of all the ones, and all under the Eastern Rite as well.
Right. That's right. But those who come through the Church of England is pretty interesting. We have a lot of priests in the United States who have family, Catholic priests who have families because they came in through the Church of England. It's wonderful. But look, the truth of the matter is that the Christian gospel could not be clearer. We all have a priestly profession. We all are missionaries. We all have the opportunity to bring the truth and the light to other people and to do so in creative ways. We get naturally better at that as we get older. So, and that's because of crystallized intelligence, among other things. And we need to take that seriously. What a privilege it is.
But as well as getting old, we also, in order to do all that, you need to stay in good condition if you can. And I know you have an amazing exercise routine. I like to swim in the Serpentine, which is today there was ice on it. So you get extra bragging rights when there's ice on the water when you swim.
Yeah,
but you have a different routine. You have a weights routine, don't you? You push a lot of weight. So how does that work? And why do you do it?
Well, I do it because I want to keep the saw nice and sharp. I want to make sure that you know, my body actually can support what I'm trying to do with my mind. The other reason that I'm pretty serious about exercise, which for me means waking up at 4:45 in the morning, and I work out from 5 to 6 every morning before I go to Mass. I go to an early Mass at 6:45. The reason that that's so critically important is because one of the things that we find in the research very clearly is that negative affect, in other words, negative feelings, are best managed through vigorous physical exercise. Now, not everybody watching us naturally has a tendency toward high levels of negative feelings. One of the things that I do a lot in my work is personality testing in my research. And one of the personality tests I find most effective is called the PANAS test, the positive affect, negative affect sequence. Positive affect means good mood. Negative affect means bad mood. And different people genetically have a tendency toward high levels of good or bad moods. You can be high in good and low in bad, high in bad and low in good, or high or low. Those are the four possibilities. And it's about a quarter of the population that's in each quadrant. In my case, I tend to be very high positive and very high negative, which
that
means
makes you the mad scientist, isn't it?
Exactly right. That's the mad scientist profile. By the way, did you take the test, Nikki?
Yeah, I took the test. Pippa and I have just taken the test literally before this. And I miscalculated. When I added it up, I was 37 positive and 20 negative, which made me the mad scientist. And
yeah, you're a mad scientist fitted. Like me.
But then I recounted and I was 37 and 16, which I think makes me a cheerleader. And Pips was 35 on borderline. And I think she was only 12 on the negative.
She's a mild cheerleader. 17 is about the average for negative. So you're right on the cusp of you have the very, 16. Very normal level of negative affect. You have a high positive affect and a normal, very average negative affect. So you're kind of halfway between mad scientist and cheerleader. But for everybody who's watching us and doesn't know what we're talking about, let me define it. So if you have high negative affect and high positive affect, it means you're a high affect person. It means you're a little crazy. You're a mad scientist, which is great for creativity. It's great for expression.
But exhausting for everyone around you.
Yeah. My wife reminded me how exhausting it is just this very morning to be married to a mad scientist. Then, if you're very high positive and low negative, that's the cheerleader, which people want to be. It's great. The problem is that you have trouble getting or giving bad news, which makes it tough for you to be an effective leader sometimes. High negative and low positive, that's the poet. That's somebody who feels negative affect very, very deeply. And that has to be managed, but it also corresponds to high levels of creativity and all sorts of wonderful gifts. And then low is the judge. That's the low affect person. These are the people who are very sober, who are unflappable, who are really great in certain high danger professions, like running a nuclear power plant or being a spy or raising teenage children or anything dangerous like that is how this comes into it. But here's the point about the exercise that we were talking about a minute ago. Exercise won't make you happier. It won't. It'll make you less unhappy. And so if you happen to have one of the two profiles that's high in negative affect, mad scientist or poet, then exercise is incredibly effective at managing the part of your personality that might be creating a barrier for your overall well-being. And for me, it's absolutely the case. I exercise vigorously with a regimen of weights and cardio exercises, 60 minutes a day. I missed 11 days in 2023. It was not because I'm some sort of cult fanatic. It's funny because my wife, when she first moved to the United States, she said, "I don't know what it is with all of you. It's like you're all trying to be on the cover of a magazine or something. Can't you lead a normal life?" For me, it has nothing to do with this. Look, I mean, I have a face for radio. The problem that I have is that my negative affect is too high, and I want to bring it down. And this is what actually makes it possible for me to be more loving and quite frankly, more in the zone of spirituality that I want to be in every morning when I go to mass. I want to be in the zone of love when I meet my Lord with his real presence every morning.
I mean, I think that's what my wife Pippa discovered. She said, even though you're away for a bit, it's good because you're better when you come back. I'd rather. But 11 days means so you don't take a day off in the week. You do 7 days a
No,
week.
I do 7 days a week.
I
I just
agree.
find that I feel a
Because
lot
everyone
better.
says you should take a day off, but I don't agree. I think do it every day.
For me, it's easier to exercise every day than most days. Because it's just easier for me to set up my day in that particular way. My wife, who's a superior individual, has greater self-presence and et cetera. She can exercise most days, and she's in spectacular physical condition. And it just you have to find out what works for you is the bottom line.
But obviously you are very routine because like that's 4:45, your alarm goes off or whatever. You do the exercise, then you go to mass. Then presumably the next bit is work, is it? Is it like that's the time when your mind is sharpest?
So what I'm actually doing is I'm optimizing for my neurotransmitters. And most importantly among them for my focus and for my creativity is dopamine. Dopamine is a neuromodulator in the brain that governs the anticipation of reward, but also the focus and the creativity that you have because of the dopamine that's in the prefrontal cortex of your brain. All of the drugs that actually treat ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, what they do is they bring more dopamine into the prefrontal cortex. And so the way that you can do that naturally, such that you can have a greater period of focus, ordinarily you can get 3 really good hours of focused creative work in a day. You don't want to waste those hours and you want to optimize those hours. The best way to do that is to treat body and soul. In other words, beat yourself up physically without trying to tax yourself mentally. Don't listen to a neuroscience lecture while you try to get under the bench press. Then, spend time in your holy hour, your prayer, your meditation. For me, it's going to mass and actually saying my prayer. Then I tank up on caffeine. Caffeine is a psychostimulant, is very effective for coaxing the dopamine along, but that's when I have it. I make sure that I don't drink it within the first 90 to 120 minutes that I'm awake for all kinds of, reasons that have been well documented in the neuroscience literature. Don't drink your caffeine too early or you'll have a crash in the afternoon. I can explain that if anybody's interested. So I have that and then have a concentration of that after mass. while I have a little bit of breakfast with my wife. And by 7:30 in the morning, I am ready to go. And then nothing gets into that slot. There's no Zoom calls. There's no conference calls. There's no nonsense. I'm doing my work. I'm working on my books. I'm working on my columns. I'm doing creative work. And I can usually get three rock solid hours of that because my brain chemistry is right based on body and soul.
Yeah. Dopamine. I mean, it's, I'm told that cold water swimming, you get 2.5 times the amount of dopamine that you get from cocaine. Is that right?
It's hard to say. I mean, a lot of that research is pretty suspect. I mean, you're going to make somebody cold plunge. I'm going to throw you in the river and then I'm going to make you, you know, spit on something so I can check your standing dopamine levels. One way or the other, what we do know is that it'll wake you up.
Yeah, no, I bite. So I do 25 minutes bite there, then I swim, then I 25 minutes bite back, and I do a prayer walk around Hyde Park as well. So by the time I come back, I feel the dopamine is very high.
You and I are more or less have the same routine, and this is a really good thing to do. I mean, to figure out how to serve your body such that your soul is actually. I mean, the truth is we know it's funny. You know, we're not Gnostics. We know that body and soul are fused in a mystical way. And so the idea of treating your body like a temple and not despising it is a critically important Christian thing to do. And also it's really good for the work that you're trying to do for the kingdom.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, you talk about the Gnostics, but I mean, one thing I was interested in is that you talk about the Epicureans and the Stoics, because it's interesting, isn't it? None of these things are new. The Epicureans thought the way to do it was like just have a lot of make yourself happy, whereas the Stoics thought it was the opposite, be tough. But those two things are still out there in the world. But there's truth in both of them. But you kind of bring them together.
Yeah. So the Epicurean, I mean, Epicurus, the great Greek philosopher, before Christ, great Greek philosopher Epicurus. His whole idea was not that he wasn't a hippie. You know, he wasn't some sort of orgiastic, you know, hedonist. He didn't believe that if it feels good, do it. He did have a belief that you should live a rigorous moral lifestyle, but largely absent tension, anger. He thought that you should be with friends and have good conversations with other people. That's how he saw it.
Yeah.
And so the way that is morphed in the common modern parlance is that, you know, you should do things that feel good all the time. You know, eat what you want, drink what you want, drug yourself, whatever it happens to be. And that's actually if it feels good, do it is one of the best ways to ruin your life very effectively and very efficiently.
And a lot of young people are doing that right now. A lot of young people.
Actually, for sure. I mean, it's certainly during the 60s and 70s. Today, the version of that we tend to see is actually, it looks like the opposite, but it's very similar, which is if it feels bad, make it stop. If I am suffering, I need therapy. I need drugs. Make my suffering, make my sacrifice cease. And that's a huge mistake as well.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a catastrophic error for happiness and a good life is trying to avoid your suffering. You know, through suffering, we find meaning, and through meaning, we actually can find is one of the great sources of happiness that we find. So, you know, a hippie, you know, smoking pot on the beach is more or less the same thing as a college student saying, if I'm suffering at all, I need to wipe it out any way that I possibly can. These are simply other ways of radical self-care that are ultimately self-defeating for the well-being that we want to bring to ourselves and ultimately to others. So that's important to keep in mind. Now, the Stoics are looking at this in a different way. The Stoics are sort of the proto-British, if you don't mind me saying that, sort of a stiff upper lip way, approach to life, which I admire. I mean,
it's a cold water dips. It's a cold water swimming.
It's wonderful. I mean, it's like my ancestor, Henry Brooks, snuck out of Lancashire in 1630, one step ahead of the law. But at the end of the day, I still have a British spirit to me, I think. And so I respond much more to the idea of bring it on. Bring it on. I want to be tough enough to actually have that. And there's a good thing about that. But making toughness a cult in itself is highly problematic as well, because you're putting something over the greater good, as opposed to seeing the toughness and self-discipline that you're bringing as a way to subjugate yourself to the greater will. right?
Yeah.
The discipline isn't the point. The discipline is a means to the greater point, which is the glory of God in the world and being a servant in this world to his love and goodness for others.
Yeah. It's so interesting, isn't it? Because you can see, I see it amongst the people, you know, the friends I have. I see a lot of people through Alpha, obviously, people who are inquiring, young people, but I also see it through, there are 3,000 members of the Seven Times. Some of them are older, some of them are younger. A lot of the young guys, it's so interesting to see the stuff they're into, in terms of psychedelics. These things morph, but they're pretty much the same. They're very fit into exercise is definitely a big thing.
Right.
But they're curious, they're searching. There's this search, the spiritual search. They may be rejecting church, but there's a spiritual search that is in every human heart.
It's true. They're seekers. I spend a lot of time in Dharamsala, which is where His Holiness the Dalai Lama lives in the Himalayan foothills. And I've been working with the Dalai Lama for the last 11 years. And
Closely. Okay.
Yeah. And he's been wonderful for me. He wants me to be a better Christian, which is a wonderful thing about His Holiness. I love him. And he's brought me much closer to Christ, I have to say. But when I'm in Dharamsala, which is a town that was just a little nothing village, in about 7,000 feet up the, you know, the foothills of the Himalayas, when he moved there in about 1960. But since then, it's become this real a pilgrimage site for seekers around the world. And so I meet people from all over the world, and they all say, I'm a seeker.
Yeah.
And to be a seeker per se can lead you on kinds of all sorts of interesting paths toward hallucinogenic drugs or extreme uses of exercise or to cults or whatever it happens to be.
Yeah.
And one of the things that people will ask me is I say, but you know, so you're big Catholic. And I said, I'm a big Catholic. I'm a Catholic at the center of my life. So you're a seeker too. And I say, yeah, but here's the deal. I'm sought. See, this is the Christian difference. This is really what people want is not to seek forever. People want to realize the cosmic truth, which is that they are sought by pure love and the divine, and then everything changes. So this turns out to be the bridge to a lot of young people that are seeking so very much, that say I'm seeking something in my ayahuasca experience with a shaman in the jungle, that I'm seeking something by studying Buddhism, even though I was not raised in that tradition. I say, yeah, but somebody else is seeking too, and they're seeking you, the cosmic love, the divine, the truth, everything. It's actually seeking you. And that's what can actually take their seeking sentiments, their natural instincts, and bring them around to what I believe is the truth that they really want, which is to be sought.
Yeah. And in that, I mean, there's this interesting thing about happiness and unhappiness, because you're not saying, you know, seek happiness and reject unhappiness. It's much more subtle than that, isn't it? That you have to, it's like embracing both.
Right. You know, the truth is that happiness has a great deal of unhappiness embedded in it, which is a beautiful thing. People want to be happy, but they don't know what they're asking for. To be ultimately happy would be undesirable, even dangerous, because that would mean the absence of negative emotions and an absence of the full experience of human life. If we got rid of our anger and our sadness and our disgust and our fear, we'd be dead in a week. If we got rid of our negative experiences, we would never learn, we would never grow. None of us would have the slightest concept of meaning, which is the coherence and the significance and our purpose in our life. We wouldn't know those things. I mean, Nikki, anybody who's watching us, if I said, you know, when did you find out what the meaning of your life is? None of them would say that week at the beach with my friends in Ibiza.
Yeah.
That was fun. But that's not when you find the significance of your life. You find that when somebody died that you loved, when you had a health challenge that frightened you, that you lost something that you cared about. That's when you figured out what you were made of and when meaning comes along. The same thing is true with every part of happiness, is it requires struggle, and it requires us to understand to push through the struggles that we actually have so that we can get to the transcendence that lies behind that struggle. And so when the most important thing that I teach my students at Harvard is for them to love their suffering, to love it, to say, you know, I don't just accept my suffering. I'm grateful for my suffering. Now, look,
yeah.
Then they're one inch away from Christianity, Nikki. Why? Yeah. Because what is the essence of transcendence? It's the man on the cross. Yeah. We literally worship a guy who's suffering, you know, and then we have the nerve to say, yeah, but I don't want to suffer. Yeah. What's that all about? That's a complete misperception of the depth and the richness of human experience and the transcendence that only living that human experience can bring us to if we're lucky to get to heaven.
Yeah. Amazing, Arthur. Well, honestly, talking to you is such an enriching experience. And I wish you were going to be at the conference this year, because I'm sure everyone, we got a great lineup, 6th and 7th of May at the Albert Hall. So for people who are coming to the conference, just say, is there anything that you can say just to challenge them, encourage them, or whatever, as we come to a close of this time together?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's like people often ask, you know, so what's the secret cheat code to happiness if I don't have any time to take your class? And the answer turns out to be encompassed in the Christian gospel and in common sense and all the research. And that's basically that happiness is love. Love of the divine, love as refracted from God in our families and our friends, and love that we can bring to everybody through the apostolate of our sanctified ordinary work. And if people come into the Alpha Conference and, you know, who are leaders in their families and leaders in their communities can remember that happiness is love, that you bring more happiness through the love that you give to other people, and you bring more happiness to yourself with the love that you experience, then we really are naturally living what the Lord told us. Remember when Jesus was asked, you know, look, 10 commandments, it's a lot to remember. give me the short version. He said, love the Lord your God and love your neighbor as yourself. And then when St. Augustine was asked, he said, you know, even that's too hard to remember sometime. What's the ultimate hack? And he said, love and do what you will.
Yeah.
And if we can do that, then people will see that through us. And if there's one thing that I can remind myself and remind all of my friends at the Alpha Conference for whom I'm praying for and admiring right now, it's remember that we should just love and then do what we will.
Fantastic, Arthur. Thank you so, so much. Hugely grateful to you.
Thank you. God bless you.